The Conservatives are the largest party. They don't have an overall majority at this stage. The Prime Minister called this election because she wanted certainty and stability. This doesn't seem to look like certainty and stability.
Welcome to Polling Politics. This week's podcast is sponsored by Ladbrokes Political Betting. Hello and welcome to Polling Politics, the election. I'm Joe Twyman from the public opinion consultancy Delta Poll.
And I'm freelance journalist Marie Lecomte.
Every week during the campaign, Marie and I round up the key political stories and statistics of the week. And we're also joined by top guests from the world of politics to delve into the polling and public opinion in more detail.
So actually, I know this is like already quite a nerdy podcast, but this is especially nerdy.
Let's go uber nerdy. Love it.
But no, so I've been quite interested in the chatter about the polls on Twitter, actually, this election. Because I feel like, I mean, A, in terms of volume, obviously there's been, I think, more chat somehow about polls than there'd been in previous elections on Twitter. But also this whole, I don't know if it's quite a conspiracy theory, but this whole thing of being like, oh, well, you know, like everyone seems to be obsessed, but party activists especially seem to be obsessed with like how polls are weighted and whether, you know, unweighting them or whatever shows that they're better polls or like, what the fuck is going on?
There's polls on Twitter and then there's the polls on Twitter,
yes.
Which is an interesting thing. There was a big thing around the debate about a poll that had been run via one of the ITV correspondents that showed that Jeremy Corbyn had won overwhelmingly, and that was conducted on Twitter. And there were perhaps some surprises when it was suggested that the effective dead heat that YouGov came up with was more representative. But the unskewed polls thing is an interesting one. It goes back to, this came up during Obama's elections in the US, where people who didn't like the results looked at it and said, well, if you take the unweighted numbers, then the situation is better. The reason that pollsters like me, and indeed all of us, apply weighting is as a fine-tuning measure to balance up the results, to make sure they're more representative of the population we're trying to survey. So we want to make sure that we've got the right number of men, the right number of women, old people, young people, etc., etc., and we can use statistical techniques to bump them up a little bit, bump them down a bit. Most of that work is actually done in the sampling to ensure that you have the right numbers, but you can do a bit in the weighting as well. And you can look at those results that aren't weighted, but they're simply not as good. I mean, it may favour another party, but that doesn't mean that it's more accurate. It simply means that it's not as representative. And so what you're looking at is that in an unrepresentative sample, people do better, which is not particularly interesting.
But that's quite interesting, because I wonder if one of the problems we're having is not that there's just too much data now. So on top of obviously there being too many polls, I think, from too many companies, etc., plus yeah, people doing their own polls on Twitter and somehow those occasionally being taken seriously, but also I think most major companies who do polls now will publish the tables alongside, you know, in the spirit of transparency, which I think in theory is a really good idea. But it does mean there's so many numbers, and it's just like, it feels very, especially again for people who are like super, super partisan, it's like, and if you don't like those numbers, we have other ones.
Yeah, exactly. This is my truth, tell me yours. Mm. Lots of people can find that. And you can always point to, even within a serving, point to something you like and something you don't like. And this has always been the way. And there is just a lot more data out there. The old joke was that polling was like a fine malt whiskey, and once a month you'd get 3 or 4 questions and you'd sip this fine data. And now it's like a fire hose that's just spraying in your face.
We can work on that. That's fine, yeah.
But on that point, actually, I mean, just this week, there was a thing about a website that just appears to be making up constituency polls and publishing results for them, which was really odd. I'm not going to name them because I'm not going to give them the oxygen of publicity that obviously a massive
spoiler,
podcast like
it
this
was me.
Yeah, exactly. It's Marie operating with a
I'm
moustache.
Bored. My insomnia's been bad recently. I had to find something to do.
They're not even doing a good job of it. For example, they said they surveyed 1,264 respondents in Dudley North, which would be impressive in itself, but they said they did it in just 2 days. I mean, you'd have to interview, on normal working hours, you'd have to interview 49 people an hour in order to get that number.
I've been busy.
Yeah, it's incredible. A phone call every 7 seconds if you're doing it by phone. I mean, I'm not quite sure how they figured they could get away with that, but that's an interesting example. example, where someone is just tweeting out real polls and then putting in their fake polls within that, and they've launched a website to back it up. I don't know what their plan is. It doesn't seem very strategic, but there you go. This has happened in the US, where people have just set up polling companies that just take the average of the polls and publish that in the hope that someone will then commission them to run a real poll.
Maybe I should do that.
Maybe.
That's a nice side hustle.
Maybe not.
I'm going to call mine Meltapool.
We'll see how it goes. But enough about any of that. Let's move on. Our guest today is Rory Stewart. Shakumaku, Rory.
Shakumaku.
Rory is running as an independent candidate to be Mayor of London in next year's mayoral election. He's the former MP for Penrith and the Borders and former Minister of State for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs. But not just that. He previously worked as a diplomat in Indonesia and Montenegro, lectured at Harvard, has written columns for the New York Times, and also took a 2-year walk across Afghanistan, Iran, Pakistan, India, and Nepal, which he turned into his book, The Places in Between. He's the former deputy governor coordinator of Mazan and Dekar provinces in Iraq. He's even privately tutored Prince William and Harry when he was a student at Oxford. Earlier this year, he also unsuccessfully ran to be leader of the Conservative Party before resigning. Rory, that's quite a background. How's your election going?
Well, we're now mounting up for an election that's going to be in May, and it's a very exciting campaign. Obviously, Sadiq Khan, who has been in for the last 3.5 years, is the front runner in this. He's got a big Labour machine behind him, and it's always generally an advantage to run as the person who's in government. The key challenge for us is to really build that volunteer base as independents, and that's raising money, and that's getting the volunteers and getting out in the streets, and making the campaign as much as possible about action rather than politics.
Now, in London, there is a history of independent candidates triumphing. I mean, first time around, Ken Livingstone triumphed. Are there many similarities between you and Ken Livingstone?
Oh, do you like newts? How do you feel about newts?
I think Ken obviously has some very, very troubling bits in his past, and I think part of that is his anti-Semitism. He's also somebody who actually was a very energetic mayor of London in many ways. Many of the things that we see in London are things that he introduced before 2008. So the bikes were his idea, the congestion charge was his idea, and one of the things that makes me a bit sad about London is that it sometimes feels as though we haven't moved on much in the last 11 or 12 years, that it's difficult to define what has actually been done. In fact, many people in London don't really know what the mayor is actually responsible for. Whereas in the United States, for example, where mayors are much better established, people have a much closer look at their record of delivery.
And one of the things that, to bring things back to current events then, one of the things that mayors are responsible for is transport. This week, Uber lost its license to operate in London. The company are appealing against this decision. How would you approach the issue of Uber and other similar apps, in the era of smartphones and ride sharing, how does the black cab and the knowledge fit into that?
Well, I think the first thing is that we clearly need a very mixed transport solution in London. There are things that black cabs work for very, very well. I use them in central London. But Uber is also filling a very important part of the market where often there aren't black cabs available. They can be actually very good for people that want to travel at night. And they are, of course, an employment opportunity for tens of thousands of people. The debate this week is around the way in which their software worked and unlicensed drivers using it. That's something that seems to have been fixed. But the bigger issue, I guess, is the way in which you run these things in a great city like London. And one of the things that worries me is that we seem to have a system which is very, very unpredictable. Everything seems to come down to these decisions whether to license or relicense. So you remember Uber was effectively banned a couple of years ago, appealed, won again, and has now been banned again, will appeal again. This isn't the way to do it. I think one of the lessons in British politics is we need to remain on top of things more. We need to grip things more. We shouldn't be just sitting back waiting for a regulator and an appeal process as though the whole thing is about a one-off opportunity to fight something in court. What I would like is a Transport for London that was solving these problems and staying on top of these problems in order to make the whole city work for people.
You talked about the sort of absence of big ideas that we've had, arguably, since the departure of Ken Livingstone. What would be your biggest of the big ideas to bring to London?
I think the most important idea is a city that works for the personal development of individuals, that really works to make this a healthy, fulfilling place to live, that we need to move government away from a one-size-fits-all towards a system that actually respects relationships, that helps us to love our neighbourhoods, love our neighbours, that engages with mental health, that engages with all the things that underlie the problems that we have. So, for example, let's take one, probably the biggest problem we face in London, which is crime, and in particular knife crime. That is partly about much better operational policing, but it's also, of course, about balancing better neighbourhood policing, more police on the streets, more knowledge, more information, with having the youth clubs, with having the investment in those communities to give people lives, fulfilling lives in other directions. And I think as Mayor of London, I want to show not just London, but cities elsewhere in the world, how we can help people over the next 20, 30 years. I believe the nature of our state, the nature of our city in 30 years' time will be completely different to what it is today. And the biggest difference is that it'll be a much more personal relationship.
Coming back to the kind of big ideas thing, I guess, like how do you condense your vision for London in the sense that I suppose it's probably a slightly tougher race for you in London as opposed to, let's say, you know, going up against Labour nationally, because CityCon is, you know, towards more the centre-left, you know, than Jeremy Corbyn is, the Labour Party is nationally at the moment. And he's nearly, and I think one of the things Sadiq has done quite well, actually, is that he's nearly quite a sort of like an apolitical, a-party political sort of figure now. He's just Sadiq, he's just the mayor, London is open, etc., etc. Like how do you go up against that, actually? How do you counter that?
The central question for the mayor, and in fact for anything that happens in democratic politics, is what has he or she done? And what are they responsible for? And how have they performed? So the question that you would be asking about CityCon in terms of the last 3.5 years has to relate to his responsibilities. He is in charge of the Metropolitan Police. He is in charge of Transport for London. He's in charge of the London Plan on Housing and Development. So the question is, do you feel safer than you did 4 years ago? Is your commute better than it was 4 years ago? Is your housing more affordable than it was 4 years ago? If those answers to those questions are all yes, then you should vote for him. If the answers are no, you shouldn't. It's pretty simple.
You're running against Sean Bailey, the Conservative candidate. Would you prefer to be the official Conservative candidate?
No. I think that these old party machines, this old politics, is dying. I want less politics. I want more action. I think the problem for Sean Bailey or Sadiq Khan is that as Conservative and Labour politicians, they're perpetually apologising for Jeremy Corbyn or Boris Johnson for their manifestos. And actually, it puts them in a very odd position. So, for example, Labour has taken a position on Kashmir. Labour has come out against private schools. Are those Sadiq Khan's positions? We assume so. He's the official Labour candidate, so he must be running on a Labour manifesto. They are proposing to borrow hundreds of billions more pounds. Is that his economic policy? We assume so. He's the Labour candidate. And the same goes for the Conservative candidate. One of the things that we have to be frank about here is that these candidates are part of political machines. They're not individuals. They don't get elected on the basis of their names. They stand or fall on the volunteers and members of their party and the ideologies of those parties, and they need to be partly judged by that. If they want to stand as individuals, if Sadiq Khan wants to say that he doesn't really approve of Jeremy Corbyn, despite having voted for him in the leadership race, despite being endorsed by him, he now doesn't want having to do with him, then he should stand as an independent like me. But if they're standing for these parties, then they need to defend these parties.
I guess my slight counterpoint to that is that one of the things we've kind of learned in the past, I was going to say in the past year, I've lost all sort of like conception of time. I cannot remember when it happened. Whenever it did, Change UK, you know, Independence for Change, etc. I thought what was quite interesting was this group of people effectively saying, you know, and not unreasonably saying, we don't agree with our parties anymore at all. We want to try something else. But then, you know, the fact that it completely fell apart so quickly and so dramatically. And I think that did kind of show that actually party machines are quite important, and actually, you know, the structures are quite important. Having people in the back rooms knowing what they're doing is quite important. So what, that's going to sound weirdly aggressive, and it's not meant to be like, you know, what makes you think you're not going to suffer the same fate?
So the reason why these other attempts at trying to create a centre ground for British politics have failed is because people in the end didn't believe that they had the ideas, didn't believe they had the competence, didn't believe that they could organise their volunteers, didn't believe they could function. In the end, these were unconvincing proposals. The individuals who ran these parties were just not able to appear as credible leaders. So my ability to win or lose the London mayoral election in the end depends on whether or not you believe that I could run London better than these other candidates. And in order to convince people that I might be able to do that, we need to keep the debate focused on what would I do, for example, to address knife crime? What would I do to sort out the signalling on the Piccadilly line? What would I do to try to engage with housing? And it's those kinds of discussions that we need to move things on to. And that's part of the growing up of British politics. We need to get away from what's happening in this election campaign, which is people spinning out fantasies which are very ungrounded, don't touch reality, and which make it very difficult for you as the voter to say, well, you know, how are you going to do this? How are you going to do this? What exactly is your plan?
Speaking of the general election campaign, from your point of view running for mayor, do you think it's better to have Boris Johnson as Prime Minister or Jeremy Corbyn?
Or Joe Swinson, I guess.
Or in the interest of balance, Joe Swinson or Father Christmas.
So, firstly, I'm not revealing how I'm voting any more than you would. I'm running as an independent now, and I will vote, but I'll keep that private. But I also think that it's very important just to focus relentlessly on what is best for London. I have to try to make a judgment, and it's a very, very difficult judgment, on what is best for London. That goes to Brexit. Right. If there's going to be a Brexit, how do we make sure that we have an immigration system that actually keeps London hospitals going, keeps London care sector going? How do we design our market access for financial services so we can actually keep the City of London going? And we're generating a surplus of £30 billion a year for the British economy out of this city. How do we keep that going? What is the national government going to do in its debt and deficit? Is it going to be able to balance the books? Is the economy in general going to collapse? What's going to happen to employment? These things are going to really matter for London. How much investment are they prepared to give us? We desperately need Crossrail 2. This is the most vibrant, fastest growing part of the British economy. So we have to look at these party manifestos and challenge them to see how are they going to invest in London. And one of the things that makes me sad, one of the things that's putting me off all these parties, is that all of them are doing this very fake, divisive, disruptive story about it's the North against London. London's got too much. We're going to put the money in the North. It shouldn't be like that. We need to do these things together. There is a lot of poverty in London. There's a lot of need in London. Probably the biggest housing need in the country is in London. And we desperately need new transport links in order to unlock new areas of the city. And that will benefit the whole country. Right? We're the engine of this country. We are, as it were, the goose that lays the golden egg. So we've got to get the balance right between necessary investments, and I really believe, for example, in the Leeds-Manchester connection link, but we need to balance that with making sure that we get the investment in London, and none of these parties are really talking about London.
As a Conservative former independent, are you still in touch with the other former Conservative independents who are running, and are you going to go on the doorstep for David Gawke and Dominic Grieve and all that, or are you?
Yes, I'll go on the doorstep for David Gawke. He's somebody who I feel immense personal loyalty to. I worked for him when he was Secretary of State for Justice. He was an extraordinary cabinet minister. He's thoughtful, he's wise, he's brave. I am very, very proud of him. He very kindly supported me in my leadership campaign, and I'll be supporting him on the doorstep.
In 2010, you campaigned and were elected as an MP in Penrith and the Borders. You're now campaigning to be elected next year for Mayor of London. Obviously,
the next one's France, geographically.
Obviously, there are lots of differences between the two. Explain to us the differences that are most obvious to you in those two competing campaigns.
Well, the first is that London is direct. I mean, the thing that makes mayors effectively now more influential than national politicians is that a mayor's relationship with the city is much more immediate, much more intimate, the impact is much more direct than you have in the relationship between a member of parliament and a constituency. The kind of things that my constituents wanted me to focus on, planning, policing, transport, were not things that as a member of parliament I had any power over. It's the power of the local mayor. So by standing to be mayor of London, I'm standing in a position where I can help people with the things that they care most about most directly. The second thing is just scale. London is a city of almost 9 million people. It's a city of unbelievable complexity. One way of thinking about it is as though it was 700 towns, not one town, right? There are huge differences, obviously, between what you see in Peckham and what you see in Evanston. These are quite different communities. So the Mayor of London needs to make sure that they don't pretend that they have the answers, but that this is generally something that is done together and where everybody is working all the time to stay on top of things, to question, to be out on the public street saying, I don't like this. Why is this happening? What's happening with the bins? What's happening with the trees? What's happening with the police? And raising these issues and shaping their communities.
When I was young, I never needed anyone.
We're joined now for our weekly chat with Matt Shaddick from Ladbrokes. Hello, Matt.
Hi, Joe.
So our constituency for this week is Esher, Esher and Walton. Don't even know how it's pronounced, but it's the constituency that Dominic Raab is standing in. There's been a lot of questions about whether Dominic Raab could lose his seat to the Lib Dems. What are the betting markets showing?
Yes, Esher and Walton, totally fascinating. Wouldn't have expected this to be a key constituency at the start of the campaign, but there does seem to be a fair bit of money for the Liberal Democrats to win this one. They were 6-1 a couple of weeks ago, and now 3-1 to unseat Dominic Raab. So, yeah, about a 25% chance he loses. And interestingly, one other unlikely-looking Lib Dem gain is the shadow Foreign Secretary, Islington South. We've seen Emily Thornberry in Islington South. We've seen a bit of money for the Lib Dems to win that one too. So You can have 20-1 that they both get beaten.
I have three things to add to the discussion. The first one is that at some hustings recently, Dominic Raab was asked which animal he would be if he could be an animal, and he said he would be a fox. The second thing is that I was
because
looking...
he likes being chased by posh the upper
men on
classes
horseback.
On horses.
Yeah, didn't we all? my second thing is that apparently one of the major settlements in the constituency is called Claygate, which I think is quite funny because it sounds like a really weird sex scandal involving clay that the Sun has renamed Claygate. And the third one is that actually Esher and Walton is really interesting because it is technically a very safe Tory seat. In another world, I think no one would be looking at it twice. But you know, it's one of the big targets in terms of like tactical voting websites. And it's one of the ones, you know, I think, because people are already talking about it as potentially the next Portillo movement.
It would be the big story of election night if it happened.
One of the defining seats of like, if that were to happen, I think it will probably end up being known like the 2019 election as the tactical voting election, because it does require actually quite a tremendous amount of Labour voters and other party voters deciding to tactically vote Lib Dem.
I guess this week is Rory Stewart. Matt, what are the betting markets saying about the London mayoral race?
Yeah, Rory Stewart, 4-1 to be elected Mayor of London next year. When he announced a few weeks ago, in all the excitement, he was briefly down to about 2-1 to win the election. Drifted out to perhaps a more realistic price right now. It looks like a bigger scrap for second place. Everyone assumes, I think, that Sadiq Khan, assuming he stands, will be one of the front two in this election. But between Rory Stewart, Siobhan Benita, the Liberal Democrats' candidate, and Sean Bailey, the Tory, it's not quite clear who's going to come out in second place and then get a chance to overtake Sadiq Khan in the final round. But Khan is still relatively popular for a politician anyway. He's 2-5 to win, so about a 70% chance that he is re-elected.
So has anything changed this week with the general election campaign? Has that had an impact on markets?
Yeah, not too many changes in the overall markets for the general election in the last week. The seat prices and the majority prices are still pointing towards a Tory majority of around 30 or 40, I guess. There was a little bit of a move towards Labour after a couple of more promising polls came out for them early this week. But right now, still a 25-1 chance that Labour get a majority. So we'll see if things change next week.
Matt, thanks very much. We ask all our guests the five big election questions, and I'm afraid I'm going to have to focus you on the general election for this. So the first of these is, what will you be doing during the general election campaign?
During general election campaign, I will be knocking on doors, asking people's views on London. I'm going to be asking them how they would like to improve London.
Is this across all of London?
Across all of London. We were out, for example, over the weekend with 130 volunteers doing Camden and Islington. I'm going to go to Brixton now. I just knock, I ask, I knock, I ask.
Next question then, what will you be doing during the election day?
during the election day, I will again be out knocking on doors across London.
It's a great time to focusing the mind.
I hope it's not the same answer for the next one.
What will you be doing during election night?
During election night, during election night, I'm embarrassed to say that I will be appearing on various television shows commenting on the election.
I don't think that's reason for embarrassment. But then
You'd say that.
Yeah, exactly. I would say that, wouldn't I? Which can we see you on?
So you should be able to see me on Channel 4 and BBC.
Excellent. Next question then, number 4, what do you think will happen?
Very difficult to call at the moment. Very difficult to call. I think there have been some catastrophic errors on both sides, but Jeremy Corbyn's interview with Andrew Neil looked pretty bad. I don't know how much influence it's going to have. But it'll be very interesting to see what happens when Boris Johnson is interviewed by Andrew Neil. I'm very struck by the fact that he hasn't yet given a date
yes,
for when he's prepared to do that interview, which would be a bit naughty. But perhaps Jeremy Corbyn should have insisted that the Prime Minister went first before he agreed to do the interview himself.
And so what do you think the overall result will be?
Looking at the polls today, a small majority for the Conservatives, losing some seats in more Liberal Remain areas and picking up some seats in harder Brexit areas.
Question number 5 then is, who do you think will be the next Prime Minister after Boris Johnson?
The next Prime Minister after Boris Johnson, almost certainly Sadiq Khan.
Oh, interesting.
I think that's the best answer we've had on that.
So yeah, that's by far the most interesting.
Yeah, no,
once you win in London, and he just has to run away back to the Commons.
It's very interesting. If you watch him being interviewed recently, he doesn't deny that he's very interested in being leader of the Labour Party. And I think that it's important to understand that one of the reasons, possibly, why I sometimes feel that he hasn't taken as much risk or made as many decisions in London as he might have wanted to do, is that he still has his eye on that job.
Playing it safe with eyes on the prize.
I think so. I mean, it would be interesting thing. But certainly when you get him on your show, or maybe you've already done that, it's worth asking. But generally, he doesn't want to confirm or deny that he'd like to run for the Labour leadership.
Speaking of confirming or denying, satirist John Oliver said it was the patriotic duty of anyone who met Rory Stewart to ask if you had ever laid a heavy tackle on either Prince William or Prince Harry while playing football. Can you confirm or deny that you laid a heavy tackle on Prince Harry or Prince William?
No, I think I haven't. I think John Oliver has managed to prove this. He's done some forensic video analysis, which has allowed him to prove that he thinks that I did not do this. He's focused on an incident. He managed to get a video clip of me playing football with William and Harry when I was 19 years old. But he tracks the video through with little circles around
it. He thinks you didn't. But what do you think?
I think probably on the basis of that video, I did not do that.
And you heard it here first, folks. And lastly, I'd like to ask you a question about data. Remain voters are statistically more likely to have eaten at a number of different chains across the country. But what do you think is the number one chain that they are more likely to have eaten than any others?
The answer must be my favourite pub, which is Pret a Manger.
That is correct. Yeah. But I'm now going to flip it round and ask, for Leave voters, what do you think the answer is? So the chain, and it not a London chain, a national chain.
Greggs.
Well,
no, I feel like Greggs unites the country.
I was going to say, we've talked about divisions across the country, but it's Greggs that does unite the country, and so it's not Greggs.
Nick, once attacked Greggs on Twitter, and generally the most abuse I've ever received on any issue has been me saying once, Greggs is only okay.
So Greggs is supported by Remainers and Leavers, so something that Leavers statistically more likely to have eaten it.
I don't know.
Toby Carvery?
What's it?
Correct.
Nice.
Marie Lacombe.
Toby Carvery.
Man of the people.
It feels very Brexit.
Yeah, it's something about the...
I was going to say, actually, Remain, my guess would have been Leon. I feel like Leon is profoundly Remain as a vibe, as a...
But that's quite niche.
Yeah, I think it's smaller numbers.
I didn't pretend to not live in a bubble. I've never pretended to.
Rory Stewart, thank you very much for joining us.
A lot of fun. Thank you guys very much. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Please remember to like, subscribe, review, all these different things that help people hear about us. And do tell all of your friends and many of the people that you don't know, even if you haven't enjoyed the podcast. This is a Poddo podcast produced by Nick Hilton, and our theme tune is by Joe Button.
For more details, go to podopods.com, and for sales and advertising, email nick@podopods.com.
And yes, that's spelled PODOTPODS.com.